So this particular model that we're using is based on Lee Smolin's real ensemble model. although the phase uncertainty does not necessarily rely on that particular, the underlying motivations for that particular model, so for this particular, we are examining this particular model because it is a hidden variable model for which I have found the, I have worked on the non-quantum mechanical regime of this model. outside of the quantum mechanical regime of the hidden variable model, you can potentially get non-local signaling in the early universe if the early universe is non-quantum mechanical. But in order for this to occur, quantum mechanics has to be an attractor solution of the. I'm sorry. Quantum mechanics has to be an attractor solution of the hidden variable, of the particular hidden variable model. So I will start with Lee Smolin's, discussing Lee Smolin's model. Then I will go on to the non-equilibrium extension of that model. And I have also taken a simple system, a spin one half system for that model, in order to examine this particular model numerically to determine whether or not it's an attractor. And I believe Niyash will talk about the perturbation theory near equilibrium and the discussions that have come about for the potential issues with the model. So in Lee Smolin's model, all the particles for which this model is based on, all the particles that are in, that would be in the same state quantum mechanically, in this case would be in the same ensemble for whatever definition of particle we're using. And whatever definition of the same quantum mechanical state we're using. This particular ensemble is based on the similarity in the situations in which it's situated and the preparations for which the state comes about, and not on the spatial distance to determine which can interact and which cannot. The ensembles evolve according to two rules. There is the continuous evolution rule, for which the phase of the system evolves. The particular system has a viable which corresponds to the observable, an additional beable, which corresponds to the phase of the particle for quantum mechanics. Out of equilibrium, there will be, you can have multiple phases with the same observable, but if you go to quantum mechanics, the phase has to be a function of the observable. So in this particular case, each of these phases evolve according to some rule. The second rule, which is different and is the non-local interaction within the system, is the copy rule, for which one particle within the ensemble will copy both the observable and the phase of another particle within the system, within the ensemble.
So, sorry, if I try to understand this, then you've got each particle in the state has, in the ensemble, has its own phase.
Yes.
And so collectively that the ensemble doesn't have a definite phase, each of the particles has its own phase.
Yes.
But now one particle can copy the complete state, including the phase of another particle?
Yes.
And but that will somehow change the ensemble as well when that copy occurs.
You will change the probability of being within a particular state, yes.
Okay, I think if you show the next step,
yes,
that is going to come on.
Well, the next one has, oh, you do have this here. So this is the continuous evolution rule. Which shows that if you have an ensemble and that you have a given phase and a given value for the observable, this particular particle, the phase will evolve. It will move along that line. And this is the copy rule, for which when you at a given time, there's a chance that a particle within the ensemble will copy the values of the beables of another one. And so you have this one and this one. This one gets copied. This one copies another one. And this one gets copied. And this one gets copied. And this copies another one. And it looks like that one copies another one. And so if you have something here where you have all of them have different phases and different values of the observable, you'll slowly gain for this discrete case, you will lose pairs of beables. And the other thing to note is that in this case, the evolution is dependent on the phase and the observable value. Not on the specific particle number. So if you have two particles that are in the same state, if, say, one of them copied the other, they will evolve the same. So this particular system, examining the equations, and given that you have two assumptions. One of them is that you have a large number of particles within the ensemble such that you can approximate the instead of using the number of particles within a given set of Biebles, you can instead use the probability of it being, of a particle being within that specific state. And the second assumption is time reversal invariance. These two assumptions come from what has been observed in nature and the rules of quantum mechanics. So if you continue with this and examine the effects of that particular thing, you can arrive at these particular two equations for, this is for the continuous evolution rule and this is for the copy rule. These two equations together are just a rewriting of quantum mechanics effectively, except for near the nodes. But these two equations will evolve identically to quantum mechanics, and if you rewrite these, creating a wave function from the square root of the probability and the using the phase to determine the phase of the wave function, you can arrive at quantum mechanics with this Hamiltonian. And the R's and the deltas, which are in here, are determined by the Hamiltonian. They must follow this, the rules that you would expect. So these R is real positive, always. And R12 is equal to R21. And the deltas, which determines the phase difference in the sines and the cosines over here, this delta here, our delta 1,2 is minus delta 2,1. And this delta has to be 0 or pi.
So it's just saying that it's the Hermitian Hamiltonian.
Yes.
So the yes. A's and B's, do they refer to the particles in the ensemble or the...
The A's and the B's in this case refer to the observable. Later it will be AI and AJ. The I's and the J's refer to the particle number, or in this case, more likely the state, just a numbering of the pairing of the states.
So the evolution of every particle in the same like horizontal slice is the same? Their phases all evolve.
If their phases are the same in quantum mechanics, for the quantum mechanical equilibrium, if it's quantum mechanical, there is one phase per observable.
I think the next slide maybe shows this.
No, the next slide just shows the outline.
But the one after the next slide. Oh, well.
No, I don't think so.
There is one, sorry. There's a cartoon
In quantum mechanics, there is one phase. If you construct the wave function, you have, for each one of these, you have forgot what it was.
Phi.
Delta. Phi, you're right. So this is the observable value. So for each one of these, there is the observable value. So there's only one phase per observable in this, in the quantum mechanical equilibrium. And the reason this is a steady state, an equilibrium state, is because if it starts out quantum mechanical, it cannot become non-quantum mechanical, because if you have only one phase per observable, there is no way to produce another phase per observable. Is there another question?
I don't think there is any.
So the next thing is the non-equilibrium extension. So yes, this does actually discuss it. So when we're determining the equilibrium form of the equations, we started with an assumption that there was only one phase per observable, because that's what's required to produce quantum mechanics. So in order to produce a non-equilibrium extension of this model, we have to assume that there is more than one phase per observable. We're going to retain the large N assumption, and the large N probably means a larger N in this case, because we have more pairs of variables. So in this particular evolution, what we're going to show is we're going to start from something outside of quantum mechanical equilibrium, and then we're going to go to something that's near quantum mechanical equilibrium, but not, might not actually be quantum mechanical equilibrium, because the way this is approached is actually not by the removal of states, by there being no particles in it. Because of the large N assumption, we no longer have, we can't just get rid of the states that way. So in this particular evolution, to get from here to here, the only ways we can do it, either by slowly draining one of these states, of all the particles, such that the large N assumption no longer holds for that particular state and eventually disappears potentially, or the phases will themselves come closer together like this. So
I guess this answers that question. So in quantum mechanics, there is one phase per observable, but in general, there could be different phases per observable, depending on the distribution.
And we'll come back to this particular thing later. So for the quantum mechanical case, we have had these original equations. So in order to go from the quantum mechanical case to the non-quantum mechanical case, we need to add the dependence on the phase in order to recognize that there is more than one phase. These particular things will add in a dependence on phase that are highlighted in red. The other thing we have to do is we have to add in a weight function. And did you get rid of the weight function?
I don't think so.
Well, I mean, you kept it here, but so we add in the weight function here. We add it in here and here because we're adding a sum over all the states. and this particular function, which this thing sums to one, and this determines the probability, if it has a given observable, of having that given value of phase. And so we also have to sum over all the phases to get the full equation. And here we add it again, because since this is the probability of being a specific phase, phi dot of A and phi and T is the weight function times the total sum for all of, for just for A and T, for all the ones that have the observable value AI. However, this is not the only place we need to add the weight function. These particular equations under the square root were arrived at by virtue of the origin, by virtue of determining what form of the equation and what form of dependence on the density is required for it to be quantum mechanical. And so these need to be maintained in quantum mechanical equilibrium, because you need to recover quantum mechanics in the equilibrium case. However, here there isn't a given way that it has to be done once we get out of equilibrium, of how the different probabilities of this depend on the particles that are in the same observable but have a different phase. The most obvious case would be to say that it is only the same if it has both the same observable and the same phase. However, in that case, if you go from non-equilibrium to equilibrium by the method of the phases becoming closer and closer together, you will have a jump in these particular values. So in order to accommodate this, we add in an arbitrary function. Great. So we highlight this here as what we need to deal with. Now, in order to accommodate this, we add an arbitrary function with the weight function, such that you can have, depending on the difference between the angle within the sum that we're talking about to begin with and the angle of the ith term, the term of interest, you have a different contribution of each particle to this particular sum for determining the densities under the square roots. This arbitrary function needs to obey a few different rules. First of all, in order to get quantum mechanics at equilibrium, this function needs to be 1 if the difference is 0. The second thing is we want it to be continuous around the phase difference being 0, in order to prevent that jump between non-equilibrium equilibrium case. And the third thing we have here is, if we want to preserve time invariance, which in some sense is optional, but it's easier just to preserve it and not for the examination of this model. We need to have the function symmetric around F0. So we have a few different functions which we have used, in which we will use in the models. This case is a flat, which means that the there is no dependence. That the difference, that for the terms under the square roots, the difference in the phases does not matter, and you sum up all of those that have the same observable value. And then we can, this should be cosine squared, I believe.
I think there's another slide which describes this. Yeah,
it's a part cosine of squared. And this is actually a cosine squared two, but then it gets cut off here and right here. It's just zero. Well, not here yet. Okay. So the last thing in order to get the equations in the final form is this particular weight function here, which I introduced for the purposes of determining what the non-equilibrium form of the equations were. There is no given rule for their evolution. So we're going to want to replace them with something that we do know the rule for evolution of, which determines that wave function, for which we have right here, which is the probability of it being in a particular observable, a particular beable pair, divided by the probability of it being a particular observable. And this we have the evolution for, so we can determine it. And that's our final form of the equations. So the next thing I'm going to go for, talk about is a sample system, which is a spin 1/2 system, two-state system, with three phases per state, per observable state. So we have two different values for A, which is spin up and spin down. And we will choose three phases for each of them. And we have a numerical code used to evolve the systems numerically using the equations that you saw above, that you saw previously. So for the different values that we need to determine, we need to put in the Hamiltonian, which is defines our values of R and delta, which is the arbitrary terms within the original equations. So in our in the program and in the terminology in which we used, we have this particular form of the Hamiltonian. We decompose it into the sigma, into the poly matrices. Yes. And we use this to determine the R and delta functions. The other thing we need, which we don't need in quantum mechanics, What we do in this particular model is we need to know what this unknown function is, and so we use a few samples, which I showed previously. The first of them is the flat function. The second is the cosine squared. And the third is a cosine squared function up until a certain point in which it's flat, a narrower cosine squared function, where we have this value of C, which determines how wide or narrow it is. And all the things we've done, we've used an integer value of C, but there isn't anything here that requires that. So we have C equals 0, C equals 1, which is the cosine squared, and C equals 10. And the third thing we need is the initial conditions. So for all the ones that I'm going to show, we use the same initial probability density. However, I have done tests with other probability densities, and it changes some of the particulars, but it doesn't change the general form of this. It doesn't change the convergence. The second thing we have, so we have here, and then we also have the initial phases. For which we have a phase difference, which we're going to use, which determines how spaced out the values are for the same observable but different phase. So this particular difference here, we have a difference between here of this and difference between these two, of 2 times the delta phi. And we have the same thing here, except we have 5 over 2 in different order. And the Hamiltonians that I'm going to use in this particular case, for the samples I am going to show, are either 2 sigma z or 2i, because it's significantly easier to see the convergence if you don't have the oscillations from quantum mechanics. So here we have, for the initial phase difference here, is pi divided by 1,000, I believe.
That's pi over 2.
No, pi over 2 is the difference between the spin up and spin down. So in this particular case, we have, this is for the case if we have the flat f function. This is the case if we have the cosine f function. And this is if we have a more spiked f function, which was the cosine but squished in and flat everywhere else. So the interesting things about this, which is reproduced with these three different f functions for a variety of different initial conditions. For this particular case, where we have the flat f function, it appears to converge here towards equilibrium by having the probabilities of four of the six lines here. Two of the red colored ones and two of the blue colored ones. So the blue colored ones are the black, blue, and purple, and the red colored ones are the red, orange, and pink, I believe. So two of each of the spin up and spin down will appear to go to zero in this case, but then they'll come back up to significant values. So this appears unstable. And you can see the evolution of the difference in the phases here. So this is the blues are for the differences between the different spin-ups values, and the reds are the differences between different spin-down values. So for the second case where we have the cosine f function, we have the same behavior as this initially. However, these values will continue to approach zero instead of coming back up. And so you have a stable equilibrium in this case. The angles do not approach zero. The angle differences do not approach zero. But the probabilities approach zero. In the third case, the probabilities do not approach zero. They stay constant, but the angle differences approach zero. In the third case, we have the spiked f function.
So basically, the summaries of the first one is the unstable, and the second and third are stable. Or used to be stable.
Used to be?
It's not there.
Sorry. It will come back up, and I do not know why it keeps going down.
No, that's it. You stay too much, honestly.
So in this particular, if we increase the difference between the initial difference between the angles here, the convergence for certain values, the convergence will remain, and for other values, you will no longer converge to equilibrium if you go further away initially. And I will show that later. So the first thing I want to show here is the standard deviation. So we took these three and we took the phase differences and we plotted the standard deviation for both the spin up and the spin down of the phase differences and obtained this particular one, this particular plot. We see here, for c equals 0, we have no convergence. For c equals 1, we have exponential convergence. This particular plot is logarithmic here and linear there. And this is a log-log plot, so we have a power law convergence. So we measured where there is a convergence, what gives a convergence and what doesn't for the different values of C, where C goes from 1 to 1,000 in these discrete increments here, and for different values of the initial phase difference, delta phi. And so we have, in this blue region here, we have convergence to quantum mechanics. This has convergence for spin down, but not for spin up for the purple points. Now, there might be an uncertainty in whether or not there is convergence within this region, or it might just be because the spin down case has a larger initial standard deviation than the spin up case. And then past this point in the red region, we no longer have a convergence. So for the broad F, these are the values you expect it to be.
Wow, this is what you got.
Well, this is the values for this, but given that you have an integer value of C, you have for the broad F that it converges exponentially and converges by a decrease in the probabilities of being in two, in all but one of the states per observable. And for the larger value C, where you have narrow F, you converge as a power law, and you converge by having the difference between the angles decrease. And here I have plotted the power law graphs for C of 2, 5, 25 is the yellow, green is 100, blue is 250, and the purple is 1,000. This is the logarithmic derivative of the power law, of the graph, sorry, to determine what the power is. So for these three, the blue and the green and the yellow, so that's 25, 100, and 250, we have negative 1.1 over here. So it's approaching a negative 1 for the power. Whereas for the narrower case, it does not seem to be approaching a value closer to minus 1, we have about minus 1.5 for the C equals to 5, and we have for the C equals to 2, it's 1.8. It looks like it's going to minus 2.
Okay, thanks, Beth. So, but before,
are you okay?
Yes, that's fine. So before I go on, I just want to stop and ask whether there are any questions or anything I can say to clarify things. Martin, you have a question?
Well, okay, so I'm somewhat puzzled by the dynamics that you are using, which is, you have a set of equations, but it's not clear where this dynamics comes from for the individual particles that you're eventually getting one.
That's right, that's right. So just let's see whether I can go back. So basically, essentially, so these are the equations. And what they say is, if you look at these particles, essentially, there is a probability associated with every particle here, right? And if all these particles are on top of each other, then the evolution is identical to quantum mechanical evolution. Right. Now, we have a liberty of choosing how these guys evolve if they're not exactly on top of each other. And that's how we wrote the equation, and there is this arbitrary f function. And if it vanishes for zero phase difference, or sorry, if it becomes unity and for zero phase difference, then in this limit you have identical to quantum mechanical evolution. If you have some phase difference per observable, like in these cases, then you have an evolution that's different. And there were the question that basically the simulations that Beth did were trying to answer was whether you approach quantum mechanics or not, basically based on this evolution that view. Yeah. Yes,
but this evolution is arbitrarily constructed, so...
But it has this structure that it's in terms of these variables, phases and probabilities. Am I going in the right direction? Yeah.
It's constructed so that it can converge to quantum mechanics.
It's constructed so that quantum mechanics is a fixed point, that if you start with quantum mechanics, if there is one phase per observable, then you will always have one phase per observable. But whether it's a stable fixed point, that was the open question that we tried to address. And it turns out that there is an option when you generalize these equations to out of equilibrium, which Beth basically developed, is by introducing this extra kernel. Is f function that basically, if you don't have a sharp distribution of phases per observable, but rather a broad distribution, then you could have basically you could introduce dependence on how broad this distribution is, basically.
But all this is dependent on having a large number of particles.
That's the assumption. So these are all the cartoons are oversimplified by it because you really want to have infinite number of particles, a very, very large number of particles, right? Okay. Yeah. Or another way of saying it is that these points that I'm showing here, they are not individual particles, but rather they each represent lots of particles with basically with huge numbers, basically, right? Okay. Good. So, yes?
I just want to make sure I understand. So, mm-hmm. zero phase difference is the necessary and sufficient condition for those two equations to reproduce quantum mechanics?
Yes.
Okay. And is there an operational motivation for the form of those equations? Where do they come from?
When you say operational, so what do you mean?
Does one start with quantum mechanics and derive those equations?
Yes. Yeah, so
and then let them be more general and leave room for play.
While I was doing it, the equations were, they started, I started with how Wiese-Bohlen originally developed the quantum mechanical versions of the equations, and I effectively worked backwards from there. I think I showed you how I did that. I didn't show you how he did. He originally arrived at the equations which are equivalent to quantum mechanics.
Yeah, so I think it's really a choice how you generalize beyond quantum mechanics. And so the quantum mechanics part, I mean, that is what it is, right? So the question is now, what direction do you want to deviate from quantum mechanics? And the direction, I guess the motivation that Lee had was that this is a hidden variable theory and different particles could have different phases. We don't observe the phases, but they determine the dynamics. And I guess the idea is that if phases are hidden variables, then there is no reason for them to be the same for all particles. Even if they have the same observable, they could be different values. Now, whether that physically makes sense, this is something that we could discuss. It's one of the many things that we could discuss, but we may not want to get into. But yeah, so that's kind of the idea, is that the phases are hidden variables, and if that's the case, why should they be the same for all particles? It could be different. And if they are different, then we have a choice of how you want to generalize the equations. So this is, in a sense, a choice, which like a minimal choice that we made by basically introducing these kernels. It basically tells you if you have a broad distribution
phases, these kernels tell you, these F functions tell you how this is modified. Is that correct? Okay. So if this wasn't here, this F wasn't here, this would add up, sum up to one. So putting F there equivalent saying that, okay, the broader distribution, if you have a broad distribution, then you get a modification here, which is, well, deviates from one. So that's kind of the motivation, but well, is this the only way or is this the best way to modify quantum mechanics? Probably that's not. This is a way to quantify quantum mechanics. Okay, so other questions? So basically, I mean, I think what Beth described very well for you was that, there's very rich dynamics. So these are very nonlinear equations. We only scratch the surface. And for the models that we looked at, there are a variety of behaviors. You either have non-equilibrium, you have exponential approach to equilibrium, or you have power law approach to equilibrium, or approximating power law. Now, what I tried to do was to make an analytic sense out of it. And so what you can do is to basically expand equations around equilibrium, basically a standard perturbation theory. We all do it and we all love it. So it turns out that the equations become extremely simplified if you're around equilibrium and you have a diagonal Hamiltonian, which makes things even simpler. And you could find, so this is basically things that you could approximately, well, I'm not 100% confident, but it seems that I have very good arguments for that for large C, basically that means for very sharp F functions, there is an attractor solution in which the difference in phases decays as 1 over T. And for broad F functions, there is an attractor solution in which difference in phases decay exponentially. So that's one thing that using perturbation theory we could show. And the last thing is that the deviation from quantum mechanical evolution, so this could be frequencies of atoms, for example, the deviation from that decays as the difference in phases or the variance of phases. And this thing decays as either 1 over e times t squared, or faster than that, it could decay exponentially. So basically, if you want to think of it physically, the energy, the energy levels of hydrogen atom, for example, they wouldn't be constant. They would have a term, a correction term, that decays as 1 over ET, 1 over time squared, say. So that's basically the simple way of thinking about it. Of course, the question is, of course, what's the origin of this time? If that's the Big Bang, that's a very long time ago. So probably this time is tiny, so you wouldn't notice any deviation from quantum mechanics. But presumably, if there is a process that could excite these phase differences, say if during the Big Bang this happens, or maybe in LHC this happens, then you might have a hope that if this theory is correct, then you might actually detect these deviations from quantum mechanics that are decaying with time as a parallel or as an exponential. So that's basically kind of the place that you want to go, the hope that you might have to detect a smoking gun for this theory, is that if there are places where deviations from quantum mechanics are excited, either in the Big Bang or maybe at very high energies, then you might be able to detect these deviations from quantum mechanics.
So let me come back to that large N approximation, the assumption that has to be made, which is now makes doing quantum mechanical experiments seem somewhat irrelevant within the context of this, because you'd be looking at an individual atom or an individual particle, not the ensemble. And so you're not really making statements here about these individual, but the properties of an individual atom or individual quantum.
Well, so that's a good question. So, I mean, that actually brings me to one of the points that I wanted to make, but it makes it, well, I mean, I don't want to go much farther. So let me just, I had some points of discussion. So let me get back to that point. But let me just get to the conclusion. given that I guess this is 4:30. So I'm going to just describe this briefly. So just to summarize, I guess if you've been asleep all through the talk, then you can just remember this, say that you've been through this talk. So the Smolens real ensemble model is a hidden variable model that adds phase uncertainty to quantum mechanics. So instead of having one phase per observable, you could have a range of phases. So that's what that's the context in which we work. So the dynamics consists of continuous evolution and copy rules. So the idea is that you have lots of particles. You represent any state with lots of particles with different phases and different observables. And then there are rules for how the phases evolve continuously and how the particles every now and then copy each other's phase and observable values, as we discussed. So if we establish the quantum mechanics as an attractor fixed point, at least for a range of parameters and a range of initial conditions, so in other words, we showed that it's for some of the models we looked at, it's a local attractor, but it's not necessarily a global attractor. It seems that for the models that we looked at, the ones that are stable, you converge the quantum mechanics faster than energy times time to the power of -2. So this is your variance, or say energies of your hydrogen atoms, energy levels of hydrogen atoms, they converge like this. Now, so this is back to the point that you were asking about. So there are really two questions that are both puzzling and intriguing. So first one is, what is an interpretation of, remind me what your question was.
Well, it's the issue of examining individual particles.
Okay, good. So this comes down to the question of, what is the philosophy behind this description? Now, Lee's original idea was that these particles really exist in the universe. That's the name, real ensemble, right? So there's, across the universe, it's an infinite universe, there are lots of particles. And so when you measure the electron in this laboratory, you're not necessarily measuring one electron. There are lots of electrons. So you're actually picking one electron out of an ensemble of lots of all the electrons in the universe, maybe. I think that's his motivation, although it's a bit hard for me to understand it. So from my point of view, this is a basic way of doing probability theory, is that there is one, so you have an ensemble of phases and particles, phases and observables, and you have a law for a set of rules for how they evolve, but really it's a reflection of your uncertainty or your ignorance. So there is really one value there, but then since we don't know it, yeah.
But the actual dynamics is determined by the difference between the spread of these phases, right?
Yeah.
So it must have, that surely can't be a reflection of your uncertainty about them if it's actually going to.
It's a very bizarre kind of uncertainty, isn't it?
it's a more statistic. I mean, it's a hidden variables theory. Therefore, mm-hmm. You know, it's actually not uncertain, but it's. We're not able to make the observations, therefore it's a statistical theory, if you want.
It is a statistical theory. Now, I take your point that it these are nonlinear equations, so I mean the probabilities don't evolve according to linear rules here. Right. So in some sense, you might expect that if it's a Markovian process, then there would be a linear rule for evolution of probability, and that's certainly not the case here. So it's a matter of why would our ignorance affect how the particle evolves the way it does? I guess a question I don't have. And that brings back, so there is really a real need for a satisfactory interpretation for this. I think that this, what if you have an operational definition? So, what to make of it is for the reader. Yeah, so I guess what you have is an operational definition for equations that reduce to quantum mechanics in some limit, but in general they're not quantum mechanics. Now, how to interpret them, I think that's something that certainly needs to be done, and I don't really have a good answer to. Now, yes, oh, okay, so that's the other point I wanted to make. Oh, I guess I just missed it. Yes, so the important point is that there is, and that's actually related to the second one. What's amazing, what's intriguing about this is it's the absolute energy that determines the rate of convergence, not the relative energy. So even if you have a single energy system, single state system, with just one eigenvalue of energy, we know that in quantum mechanics, the evolution is boring and trivial. But the actual value of energy here determines how fast you converge to quantum mechanics. So this is very surprising, because in quantum mechanics, and classical mechanics for that matter, it's only the difference in energies that matters, except in case of gravity. In this case, also the difference in energy is not relevant. It's the absolute value of energy which determines how fast you converge to quantum mechanics, and that's why there is a potential application to either early universe physics or to the cosmological constant problem. Because gravity is the other place where the absolute value of energy matters, because it's the total energy that gravitates, not the difference in energies. So there might be an interesting connection between this possible type of extension of quantum mechanics and early universe physics or other processes in quantum gravity, because they are both controlled by the absolute value or the total energy of the system, not just the energy difference. So that's, I think that's probably a good place to stop, unless there are questions. Thank you.